Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. I had put the title Doobie Doobie Doo on this short series of considerations of what can help us thrive or do a bit better when we're in times of transition. And I find myself wanting to temper my language, any language that sort of suggests in all of this hauling ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Does that idiom still even work? Like, I mean, Blundstone wearers notwithstanding. Does anybody still have boots with straps on them that you could... Anyway, do we know what that means? Help yourself. It means help yourself, right? And I want to temper my language around help yourself because, in part, because it comes with all kinds of assumptions that are attached to that notion that really might not be true for everybody. And not the least of those assumptions is that we all find ourselves able to just try harder. And that is not necessarily the case. We are not always able to just try harder. And so with that in mind, let me suggest a little different perspective on these ideas. And it does come with a not dissimilar set of assumptions, but with a little adjustment. Instead of try harder, I would like to propose as a starting point for the things that I'm going to unpack a little bit this morning, I would like to propose try different. Not try harder, but try different. It still assumes the capacity to try. So I'm not being blithe about that, but that's sort of where I want to come from. Try different. If you've had occasion to experience the privilege of being in settings where your spoken language wasn't the primary one or where your culture wasn't the dominant one, you might have encountered in yourself or maybe in somebody that was within earshot that inclination to try to surmount a communication barrier by trying harder. And some of you already know what I'm talking about. What it often sounds like is saying the same thing you already said but louder, right? And then if that doesn't work, louder and slower. Like we were speaking with someone whose ability to communicate as a category was fundamentally less than ours as a communicator. And this is a bit crass, perhaps, but if you've ever found yourself doing this, don't answer this, but just check in with yourself. Was it accompanied by an internal voice that was saying something like, what is this person's problem? Or judging their intelligence categorically or their capacity categorically. What, is this person dumb? Not able to speak sense, but in the intelligence sense. The point, of course, is that trying harder isn't without value, but it's also not always the solution. And in that scenario I just described, being aware that there is a language barrier, being aware of the problem, and then looking around for another way to communicate, whether that's finding somebody bilingual to help out or firing up Google Translate or whatever we do, is appreciably more effective and also potentially much kinder to all the parties than shouting is. And I think it's worth remembering that in that little scenario, the little language barrier scenario that I just laid out, one of the parties whose ability in that scenario, whose ability to build trust and connection with others is the shouter, not just the shoutee. Just try harder can hurt the trier, especially if we don't know how or if it hasn't occurred to us that trying hard or trying harder needs to be balanced with other approaches. That it goes somewhere, but it doesn't go everywhere, if you want to say it that way. When it comes to thriving or doing better in times of transition, doing, which we considered last week, and if you weren't here, haven't kind of checked in with some of those ideas, the podcast is up on our site. We can benefit a great deal by balancing doing with being. and just really broad strokes. And so we're going to get into that in more detail shortly, but just a quick review of the doing part. First, last week we explored the potential benefits of having a model, a theory, if you will, for when we're in times of transition. This is how we were defining, and I'll continue to be working from this understanding of what transition is. We could define it other ways, of course, but we said that a transition was any change in circumstances, whether personal, professional, or societal, that shifts our status quo. And by status quo, I meant our existing state of affairs. Right? So that's what we're talking about when we talk about transition. And the model that we talked about for this had these three parts to it: ending, letting go, losing, acknowledging what's being left behind. And we talked a fair bit about how important that is in a transition process. And we talked about the neutral zone, this liminal space where we're aware of the uncertainty and discomfort of being in between. We're neither here nor there. And we're actively in transition and we're conscious of that. And then new beginnings, where we start to embrace a new chapter and new possibilities. We talked in all of that about the importance of things like cultivating patience and embracing flexibility, seeking support, taking small conscious steps, practicing self-care, and reframing the story that underpins our meaning-making, because lots of times that needs some adjustment when we're in transition. And then as a sort of subtext last week, we felt like we kept circling back to the importance of being patient, which is, for me at least, counterintuitive. It is not what it feels like, not what I feel like being in transition lots of times. But we kept circling back to dispensing with the notion that we should be able to solve everything quickly, perfectly, and completely. And I'm tempted to say, of that notion that we should be able to solve everything quickly, perfectly, and completely, I'm tempted to say, if only life were so simple, except that I'm honestly not sure a world in which we could solve everything quickly, perfectly, and completely would be better. This is an uncomfortable idea. I can certainly see the appeal, particularly if we're in the middle of acute suffering. But given how much wisdom we tend to acquire through our wrestling with mystery and even within suffering, certainly with intention, there's a part of me that suspects that a world in which everything is solvable might be a bit flat, a bit dull. Incomplete might be a better way to say it. Now, again, if you're in the middle of acute suffering, that might just all sound like luxurious philosophical nonsense, and I can appreciate that. Maybe another occasion for seeking balance, right? So, in the interest of bringing some balance to all of that doing that we looked at, with some considerations of being, I want to move on to some ideas about what might help us live as well as we're able in times of transition, with a focus on being. So, it's a little pause in the early going here for some self-reflection. My first draft in my notes of the sentence that I just said, read this way: so in the interest of bringing some balance to all that doing, with some consideration of what sorts of being, let's move on to what might help us do as well as we're able in times of transition. I couldn't get through one sentence about being without coming back to doing. I was right back to that language, and I went back and changed it, but I noticed what was happening. So that might not be your story, of course, but I feel like I have a giant magnet in my life that pulls me toward doing. And I'm not going to drag you through all the dark alleys of my own psyche on this one, except to say that it seems to be a whole life project for me to bring anything like balance to this. It really does. So if I seem a little bit intense about considering being, it's probably me preaching to the very small choir of one. That is me, and you know, you're welcome to listen in. This stuff is challenging for me, for sure. All right, so on to some of what might be helpful to be in times of transition. And I'm going to do this kind of like I did last time, with a bit of an outline to say, here's some particular notions about this that we can put language around and that might help us carry some of them away. Watch for the one, as I've said before, but watch for the one that's for you, right? Watch for the one where you feel like, oh yeah, there we go. I should lean into that a little bit and explore that. So the first stop is be resilient. These can all sound like mini lectures. Just be resilient, right? Like, just do it. Like it was so simple. So resilience is one of those words that feels to me a little bit like thriving, maybe, that gets tossed around so much these days that it can start to sound like blah, blah. Like, it just sounds like background noise. We're always on about resilience and its importance. It is important. And also, we can overuse words. When that happens, I think it's easy to lose sight of what a word might actually mean. And I think that can happen easily with resilience, because I feel like it's pretty natural to misunderstand resilience as some kind of stoic toughness, right? A lack of feeling that helps us just suck it up when we're suffering. But that's actually not what resilience means at all. It doesn't mean does not, to be clear, does not mean being unaffected by challenges. That is not what resilience means. In fact, some of the most resilient people I know are folks who feel deeply and know how to make themselves available for challenging emotions, things like sadness, fear, disappointment, anger, and so on. Resilience is our ability to feel deeply, to acknowledge a setback or a loss, back to stage one in our model from last week, and then make our way back from that. And that all of those bits are important. If we stay in that space of emotions, or feelings if you prefer, for a moment, emotional resilience depends in no small part on our willingness and skill, our capacity for feeling deeply, even when those feelings are unpleasant or de-energizing, and learning to regulate, to process, make space for other feelings, all of that good emotional intelligence bundle. To cultivate resilience, and for me, cultivate is a deliberate word choice, an organic word choice that has to do with both the weeding and the joy of harvesting, all of the gardening bits. To cultivate resilience is to learn to embrace vulnerability, which there's all kinds of reasons why that's difficult. And then in the midst of that, to do things as a practice, like choosing gratitude, even when it's hard to do, and sometimes it will be ridiculously hard to do, and staying open to new perspectives. We're going to talk about that last one more in a moment. That's quite a list, isn't it? Embrace vulnerability, choose gratitude, and stay open to new perspectives. Would that we all could do such things readily and in a way that starts to feel like the natural practice for us. Natural practice is a functioning oxymoron. It becomes natural when we practice. That's how we make something feel natural for us, when it's an acquired skill. We practice it. So these are all things that, at least for me, require practice. They're not default settings. So that's the first idea. The second idea about things that we can be in transition that can help us transition as well as possible is we can be curious. And this is absolutely one of my favorites. Transitions often bring opportunities to learn new things about ourselves, about the world, about others. But, as is often the case, as humans, we tend to see what we're looking for. And that tendency, which is built in, it's one of the ways we survive in the world. We don't see everything. We don't process everything consciously. In fact, we process remarkably little consciously. And one of the ways we survive and navigate the world is by not seeing everything. We see what we're looking for. And that means, among other things, if we're not looking at whatever change it is we're facing, and just a reminder, as we talked about last week, change is the external piece, transition is the internal piece. If we're not looking at whatever change it is that we're facing with an eye to learning new things, we probably won't see opportunities to do so. We're going to be fully occupied in other ways in that transition. There'll be plenty there to occupy us. So this is a choice as well as a practice. Now, again, I want to be careful with that idea because it's just a little too easy for it to turn into blame the victim kind of thinking. Not seeing any opportunities, it's because you're not looking for them. It's you. You're the problem. And we got to be careful with that stuff, right? Not seeing opportunities because you're not looking for them, I think, can be rather short-sighted and dismissive, and there might be all kinds of factors that make it hard for us to be curious. That kind of thinking, you're the problem, you're not seeing opportunities because you're not looking for them, I think that sort of thinking can put us fairly easily on the short path to what we might call toxic positivity, which is its own kind of wild imbalance of something good. Is it good to be positive? Yes. Is everything good? No. Not coincidentally, I think this is also a shape of thinking that often gives rise to religious systems that blame the sufferer for not getting the preferred result to a particular theological system that's supposed to deliver something. So if you're God didn't take away brackets in my notes, your cancer, make you rich, heal your kid, pick one, whatever it was you were asking God for, the reason is because you didn't truly believe. That's the same shape of thinking as you didn't see any opportunities because you weren't looking for them. You weren't curious because you chose not to be, and so on, right? It just shifts it all back to the person who's needing to and wanting to do the work. In that frame, one of the things that I really appreciate about curiosity as a way of being is that, in stark contrast to rigid either-or ways of thinking, this is an attitude that can keep my thinking fluid. Or if that conjures unpleasant images, try flexible. Fluid thinking might be a little too squishy. As I've gotten older, and what I'm trying to be here is honest, not ageist, I've found that physical flexibility doesn't spontaneously maintain itself. It takes deliberate effort not to atrophy, as far as I can tell. I find something similar to be true, at least in my lived experience, when it comes to mental flexibility, ideological flexibility, spiritual flexibility. Some of us might have been taught, in particular, when it comes to what we believe, that being inflexible is a virtue. Having strong beliefs and deeply held values can, of course, be admirable and important. But I think, and I couldn't find satisfactory language for myself here. I'm going to use the language of tipping point, but it feels a little too mechanical. Just so you know, you might have better language for this. I'd love to talk to you about that. I think there is a tipping point between deeply held and intractable. And I think it's a real one. And we might not find that tipping point easy to discern, but we probably have some sense of what it looks like when we encounter it, especially if it comes at us as judgment or shaming or ignorance masquerading as truth. Curiosity, knowing that I don't know everything, just that, can help me be open to learning in a way that certainty does not. And I think that's important. And I think it can also help us to steer clear of playing God, especially if our conception of God includes some sort of an all-knowing deity, which if you grew up around the Christian tradition, the odds are pretty good that that was part of the picture. My mom would have said something like, nobody likes a know-it-all. Mom, I'm trying. I just want to be a know-it-all. It'll be a lifelong challenge to not want to be a know-it-all. But my mom would have said, nobody likes a know-it-all, and she would have said it to me for good reason. And she wouldn't have added this, but over the years, I think I would add, and saying, yes, but I'm right, doesn't change that. being convinced. I had a mentor one time who said that sincerity is not a good measure of truth, which is a similar sort of space, right? Being curious can keep pulling our gaze back around to what we might learn, even when what we think we know is being very insistent for us. And if you're the kind of person that might be listening to this and thinking, well, that's interesting, Tim, but what does it look like in practice? Let me just make one suggestion. And this is a personal practice, and I expect it'll be a lifelong practice. I don't expect I'll get good at it, but I hope to get better. Next time you're in a conversation and you find yourself inclined to make a statement about something, just try to think of a way to turn your statement into a question. Just that. That sounds easy, right? Go try. I don't know. It might be easy for you. Holy mackerel. This takes so much work sometimes. But when I do it, it almost always elicits something way more interesting from the other party than whatever clever thing I think I should say. And absolutely, I learn more. I already know what I was going to say. I was planning to say it. I had something formulated. One of my friends who kind of thinks out loud with me about these same sorts of things sometimes likes to say, I know what I know about this situation, interaction, circumstance from my perspective. What do I know about it from the other person's perspective? And the answer is nothing unless they tell it to me. Like, that's the only way I can know what the other person's perspective and experience is. And odds are pretty good that they're going to tell it to me way more freely and substantially if I ask for it. And that comes back to whatever I was going to say. Try to find a way to turn it into a question. I have a thought about that, and it leads to a question. Say the question before the thought. Just as a practice. I could go on at length about this. Like I said, it's a favorite, and it's a perennial space of effort and practice for me. Well, there's a couple more being ideas that I want to mention, so I'm going to move on. So we touched on this next one as a doing part of thriving in transition when we considered self-care, but it does overlap into the being space as well. Be kind to yourself. So, just for fun, just listen to the sentence. Do you ever find yourself stuck in the loop of condemning yourself for not showing someone else more empathy? Okay, one more time. Do you ever find yourself stuck in the loop of condemning yourself for not showing someone else more empathy? Just let that perk. Why would we offer someone else empathy or compassion? So at the big idea level, there's lots of reasons, but maybe one of the core ones for us as human beings is that we would do that because we believe the other person or persons have innate value. Innate means they arrived in the world valuable, not acquired after birth. It arrived with them. So here's a rhetorical question, but is there anyone who didn't arrive in the world as valuable? Or is there anyone who arrived in the world as less valuable than me or less valuable than you? What about you? Did you arrive in the world with innate value? So see what I mean? If you have innate value, you're worthy of empathy. They go together. If you have innate value, be kind to yourself. So that's what makes the sentence absurd. Condemning myself for not showing enough empathy to someone is just like it's like a double miss, right? I'm not valuing myself when I do that. And I'm not doing well by the other person. So when it comes to navigating tough times, self-compassion is key. I find that it can sort of help me to flip the golden rule around so it says something like, don't do to yourself something you wouldn't do to someone else. And there are traditions in which that is the way that rule is stated, more or less. Or to state that same thing more positively, treat yourself with the same empathy you would offer to someone you find valuable. And then the practice, of course, is to learn to find valuable those who are different from me, right? There's also a link here to that drum that we keep beating about not having to get things right all the time. Perfectionism is the enemy of self-compassion. It's like that cartoon of the donkey chasing the stick, right? Where it's always just out of reach. If we have to get something perfect before we feel like we can treat ourselves with acceptance and kindness, we're always going to be chasing that moment and we're never going to experience it. Because we're human. And we're not going to get it perfect. That's just not the way it works. And that's what I mean by a sort of a categoric statement like perfectionism is the enemy of self-compassion. Making mistakes is one of both the most ordinary and most important ways that we learn. And I would argue that it's not just okay to make mistakes and learn from them. And I know this can be a costly way to learn. We could all tell stories. I would say that's the low bar, that it's okay to make mistakes and learn from them. I think it means that we're a normal human being. When we make mistakes and learn from them, we are doing something that we are equipped to do. But we may have been taught we shouldn't do. So we've got some unlearning to do, perhaps, on this one. Some of us more than others. And let me just add that having support, which we touched on last week, is a very important component of this. There's lots to explore there, but I want to move on. So, in all of this, it's helpful in terms of being to be present to the moment that we're in. This moment, and I know it's a bumper sticker, I think it's also true, this moment is the one that we have. Right here, right now. This one. Already gone. This one. Already gone. That's the way that works. We can't have the past back. If you were thinking about something else, that last moment that I just mentioned, you were thinking about something else that moment. Right? Not a critique, just reality. We can't have the past back. And we don't have control, influence and agency, yes, but not control over the future. This is the moment. And whatever transition we're in is the moment we have access to. And being present to it can help us to fully engage with whatever's going on both around and within us in that moment. I find it interesting that the religion I grew up with had a kind of both-and take on this that I'm slowly learning to revalue. I kind of feel like it's a recovery process here for me. In that context, I learned that many of my best longings should be treated as deferred. Someday in the sweet by and by, all's going to be well. So for now, I should just suck it up. I should tough it out. I should be faithful. And that's what it meant to be faithful, was to do those things. But then in the same breath, I was taught this sort of spiritual notion of waiting on God, which can facilitate a particular religious version in practice of be present. On the drive here this morning on the show that was on CBC, the host was interviewing a rabbi. And one of the things that this rabbi was talking about, sort of inevitably, was the experience of what it's like to be, in this case, a Canadian person of Canadian Jewish conviction and persuasion, and for a rabbi of practice, and how difficult that has been because of the rise in anti-Semitism and so on. In the process of that conversation, he talked about, and I've mentioned this here before, the Hebrew practice of Midrash, which is taking stories as they exist in the texts and recasting them, retelling them in other ways, to ask what lesson does this story have for us now, in this moment. What I didn't know about that practice, and I find deeply fascinating and quite heartening, was that it includes extra-textual stories, and they're equal players in that tradition. So Midrash includes what we might call apocryphal stories, stories that aren't captured in the text, but they exist in the tradition. And they're meant to challenge the stories that are there in the gathered text, in the canon. And the one that he told, I found very moving. He said that one of the Midrash stories that goes with a hugely popular and pivotal text, which is the story of the Israelites fleeing from Egypt, crossing the desert, going through the Red Sea, parting of the sea, and then the Egyptians show up, and oh no, it's this brief one, freedom is going to end too soon. They go into the sea, and the sea crashes back in on them and drowns them all. And the angels in that story are dancing and celebrating. In the Midrash story, God shows up and chastises the angels. He says, no, no, no. This is not a thing to dance and celebrate. Those are my children too. Wow, right? There's some tension. That's a corrective. And the rabbi, of course, thoughtfully told this story to talk about the dilemma of the conflict in Gaza. And how do you, as a Jewish person, celebrate the possibility of having a state, which is very, in terms of history, a brief experience for that nation, and also have this conflict with a group of people, an organized group of people who are trying to really, in many ways, accomplish a similar thing for their people by violence and then the collisions of those two violent approaches and all of that complexity, right? No, those are my children too. Wow, okay. And then his point was that within this tradition, if it's in good repair, we have that conversation. We talk about that difficult thing. We talk about that tension. We don't hide it away. The benefit is in the tension and the conversation. Now, whether we find that kind of tension within a religious system or elsewhere, I think there's something important here to attend to. When I sat down for breakfast on Friday, this book, Worldly Girls, was sitting on the table, not my book, and I hadn't, it'd been there for a couple of days, but I hadn't taken the time to pick it up and see what it was about. And when I did, the first thing that I did was skim the jacket blurbs, as one does. And the back cover summary says this: Tamara Young's powerful memoir documents the slow unraveling of her connection to her faith and the tragic history of her fractured family, shining a light into the dark corners of memory that have haunted her well into adulthood. And then this partial quote on the inside flyleaf from a different author, Anahad Dashgard. And Dashgard writes this: Tamara Young has written a deliciously subversive book, listen to this part, about ideologies which allow us to survive while also imprisoning us. A brave set of storied memories about growing up with a Nova Scotia mother who raised her as a Jehovah's Witness and a Chinese immigrant father who resisted. This book is about growing up in the in-between space, what we anchor to when there are a few absolutes and how we move beyond the ties which bind us to find our own path forward. A little bit later in that same bit, Dashgard writes of, quote, being informed but not bound by our ancestry. The in-between space, she says, were what we anchor to when there are a few absolutes and how we move beyond the ties which bind us to find our own path forward. Now, for me at least, that captures a lot of what I've been trying to say. I feel like it's a very apt as well as a beautifully articulated capturing of what it can feel like to be in transition, especially if that transition is in the realm of what we believe. Ideologies which allow us to survive while also imprisoning us is the sort of perspective that grows out of being present to the moment, even when, maybe especially when, that moment is full of unresolved tension, when we are deeply engaged in that neutral or liminal in-between space. Which I feel like defines many of the experiences for many of the people in this community. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to park there for a moment. Okay, one final being for us, and then we'll leave this moment. We'll go to the next one. And all of this fluidity, tension, liminality, it can sure be helpful to be hopeful. And I don't regard it as my place to tell anyone else where to ground their hope, not least of all because I've learned that there are as many ways to do that as there are people who do it. What I will say is that choosing to believe that there is something of benefit for us to take away from times of transition. Now, don't mistake me for saying transition is caused by some greater being so we'll learn a lesson. I think that's a short version to a really busted version of a bunch of things. But this, which I would hope would be a little more nuanced, I think that choosing to believe that there is something of benefit potentially for us to take away from times of transition can really help us to stay in the game, even when it looks and feels very difficult. And I think that's where that other idea comes from, potentially. Personally, I also find it very helpful to take a long view of hope, or to at least entertain the thought that whatever the benefits of a particular transition that I'm experiencing might be, those benefits might not be for me. They might be for someone who comes after me. That feels important to me. Maybe less important than it did when I was 20. But it feels really important to me. And it can help me focus, and this might seem a little bit counterintuitive, but I find that that long view can help me get the focus off me and onto the present moment. I can be present to what's going on because I don't have to burden that moment with what's in it for me, if that makes sense. If it doesn't, let's talk about it later. I find that that helps me to do a little better in times of transition. My hope with that idea and all of these is that you'll find it helpful as well. Peace.